Now, Iran elected a new president on Friday, Ebrahim Raisi. On Monday, President-elect Raisi said that Iran would not give up its development of ballistic missiles and that he would not meet with President Biden. Raisi made these comments as efforts are underway in Vienna to renegotiate the Obama-era nuclear deal. Under that 2015 agreement between seven countries, Iran agreed to limit its development of nuclear weapons. In 2018, then-President Trump abandoned the deal. President Biden faces a tough road to get it back on track. You could join in on at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on U.S.-Iran relations? How should the U.S. work on nuclear non-proliferation in Iran? Should that be a big U.S. priority? Do you want to see that Obama-era deal come back, or did you see problems with it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Rupal Mehta is an associate professor of political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and the author of Delaying Doomsday, The Politics of Nuclear Reversal. Rupal, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, it's a rocky road, clearly, on this deal. Based on where we are, new president of Iran, these negotiations going on in Vienna, what do you think the prospects are that we come back to an effective agreement?
I'd say the prospects are pretty mixed. For one, I mean, I think that there's been a lot of constructive conversations under the new administration in Vienna. But ultimately, from the Iranian perspective, most of these decisions are made at the supreme leader's level, at the Ayatollah Khomeini's level. So the new president probably won't have a lot to say that is not directed from the Ayatollah himself. So assuming that the Ayatollah is willing to continue with these conversations, I'd say we're on track to at least have a somewhat productive negotiation, but a lot of it will really just be a test of time and the strength of the negotiators at the table.
There is this new president in Iran. There was an election. I'm throwing some little air quotes on that because the religious leaders of the country kind of pick and choose who the candidates get to be. The choice of this president, Raisi, does that send a message about how willing the leaders of Iran are to come back to the table and work on this?
I actually think it sends a more interesting and potentially more important message about the Iranian public. With only about a 49% turnout for this election, which is dramatically lower than the 2017 election, which actually had a moderate come to power, former President Rouhani. I think what this suggests is that given the slate of candidates that were approved by the Supreme Council and the Ayatollah, this was the best of the options available, but certainly suggests that there's not a strong appetite for hardline politics in Iran, especially if it comes at the cost of more increased punishment through economic sanctions.
We're talking to Rupal Mehta, author of Delaying Doomsday, The Politics of Nuclear Reversal. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Looking at Iran, the U.S., and nuclear negotiations, you can join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rupal, I want to look at the initial Obama-era deal. One of the big criticisms from Americans, conservatives in particular, was that, okay, yes, it tackled nuclear weapons, but it didn't get into things like ballistic missiles or Iran's support of terrorist organizations, especially in the Middle East. As someone yourself who has studied this idea of nuclear reversal, should we be getting those other issues mixed into our nuclear weapons negotiations?
I definitely understand the perspective that having to tackle those issues would be great. Obviously, I think everyone wants to see a more safe and stable region in the Middle East. But tackling on some of these other issues, especially ballistic missile production or support for non-state actors, is really tough when you're already dealing with something as contentious as nuclear weapons. I think from most perspectives, focusing on the single issue was the only way that we were going to see any traction. And I think even going into the next iteration of a deal, it's probably going to be true that we're going to have to limit the scope of the negotiations in some part. But I take the point that this is something we all want to be working on. And so hopefully future discussions can focus on ballistic missiles or on support for non-state actors.
With the original deal as constituted until it was overturned in 2018 under the Trump administration, from what we can tell, Rupal, was it working? Was it keeping Iran further away from developing nuclear weapons?
Yeah, the best of our intelligence and our knowledge coming from both parties to the agreement, which is the United States, members of the P5, the permanent members of the UN Security Council, as well as international organizations like the International Atomic Energy Agency and relevant interested parties like Israel, all show that the deal was working, that Iran was complying with the agreements and limiting its production of nuclear-related materials and infrastructure. So it was a bit of a disappointment to almost everyone involved that the deal was abrogated. So that's a good sign. I mean, I think that the fact that the deal was actually being adhered to during the short amount of time that it was in play is actually a very good sign.
Now, you started that answer, though, with as far as we know. Was there enough, I guess, verifiability, transparency in that deal to where we could be pretty sure that Iran wasn't doing something kind of behind the curtains?
Well, I definitely don't have any access to classified information, but from what I can tell from all the open source data, from all of the transcripts and reports from the United States, from the other parties of the agreement, from the IAEA and other international organizations that were focused on exactly that point, they seemed satisfied with the transparency of the regime and its adherence and compliance with the agreement.
I want to look at the motivations for a country, especially a non-superpower country, when it comes to the question of whether or not to develop nuclear weapons. And I've heard the argument that countries might look at Libya and Muammar Gaddafi didn't get nuclear weapons and he's dead. Iraq, Saddam Hussein's dead. North Korea, Kim, is alive. Is there an existential justification argument for a country, say an Iran-sized country, to say, you know what, it's worth it to have this deterrent?
That's certainly one of the arguments that especially the academic scholarship and some of the policy community have been basing their understanding of these programs on. If you look at just the historical record, it seems like rogue actors, especially those that don't have robust, superior conventional or nuclear capabilities, are often vulnerable to foreign imposed regime change or other types of attacks in the international system. I think if you were to gather intelligence from Kim Jong-un or from other actors that are interested in nuclear weapons, they would cite those examples of Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein as reasons for why they themselves wanted nuclear weapons. I think for other countries in their position, it's a question of power, it's a question of resources, it's a question of prestige, and maybe even pressure from within the military to want to develop this very expensive but very lucrative type of technology.
A lot of these negotiations, I mean, key players here, Iran and the United States, and both countries have a lot of reasons not to trust each other. Iranians point toward a CIA-backed regime change in the mid-1900s and support for the Shah of Iran. Americans think back to the hostage crisis of the late 1970s. How do you overcome that kind of lack of trust between two key parties in this kind of negotiation?
It's very tough, and it's definitely not made easier by particular parties unilaterally withdrawing from an otherwise operating and productive agreement. I think the key here, though, is to increase information transparency, to work to show that over time there's lengthy periods when all the parties are agreeing to the agreement and they're complying with the agreement, and then ensuring that even if there is regime or party change within a particular country, that the successors to those that signed or ratified this agreement also uphold it. I think it's just a matter of time to really convince other parties, even our allies, that we're serious about this agreement and that we're going to remain committed to it as long as the other parties themselves are complying.
We continue our talk with Rupal Mehta. She is an associate professor of political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and the author of the book Delaying Doomsday, The Politics of Nuclear Reversal. We're looking at Iran and the U.S. and nuclear negotiations, a deal under the Obama administration, repealed the deal under the Trump administration in effect, and some talks still underway, a new administration in the U.S., now a new president, for what it's worth, in Iran. You could join in with your questions, your thoughts, hopes, or fears about a new deal. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Rupal, could you point toward any countries in the past where we've had successful nuclear reversal that might give us lessons, a roadmap here as we talk about Iran?
Yeah, there's actually been a few. In fact, many more countries have successfully reversed their nuclear programs at various different stages of production. So they do provide a good, I think, roadmap for us. I think the most prominent and the most famous is probably South Africa, where after they developed and built an operational nuclear weapons program, they then dismantled it and gave up many of the component parts of it to the international community, specifically to the IAEA and other actors to ensure that they were now non-nuclear. But we also have instances of other countries that started and began a program but didn't complete it, including Australia, Switzerland, Sweden, Norway, where, you know, we were basically providing them with a series of carrots and sticks to ensure that they didn't want to pursue nuclear weapons. Some of those incentives were military assistance or economic assistance, other types of goodies that would make the deal sweeter, so to speak. And some of the sticks that we were using, especially with non-allies or adversaries or opponents of the United States, were threats of preventive military force or economic sanctions like the ones that we've seen imposed against Iran recently.
Should we have sanctions in place against Iran in the meantime? This is a key sticking point in negotiations leading up to 2015 and negotiations now.
Yeah, and it's a really tough one. I think one that has continued to sort of be the cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy. One argument for having sanctions is that it does cripple the regime a little bit, enough to want to come to the negotiation table. Whether or not it actually delays any nuclear progress is another issue. And from all the evidence we've been able to gather, me and many other academics, we don't see a lot of evidence that economic sanctions actually prohibit progress on a nuclear program. But what it does do is encourage leaders to want to speak to the international community and engage with the international community in an attempt to get those sanctions reversed. And in fact, one of the biggest sticking points in the current or the most recent Iranian election, where we saw now President Raisi win, was the fact that the United States had reinstated economic sanctions against the Iranians, which has now been one of the main parts of now President Raisi's interest in engaging or at least speaking a little bit with the United States, is to get those economic sanctions reversed.
And that seems like a sticking point in these Vienna negotiations. If I understand correctly, Iran says, hey, drop these sanctions, then we talk. And the Biden administration says, start talking, and then we'll drop the sanctions. Is that about where we are right now?
That's exactly where we are. And it's a pattern that we keep seeing repeated. And this is also true with the North Koreans. This is true in a lot of other contexts where we see actors engage in nefarious or poor behavior. We sanction them to try to get them to stop the behavior, but they won't stop the behavior unless the sanctions are lifted. And this is especially concerning, or especially, I think, important and interesting in this case, because the now president of Iran, President Raisi, is actually a specific target of economic sanctions from the United States. So that's going to be a really important issue for the negotiators to navigate or to muddle through. One would be to have legislation or some sort of guide frame that basically allows for the sanctions to be immediately snapped back if there were to be an abrogation of an agreement. But even that's really tricky, in part because, again, these sanctions don't really impede progress. Mostly what they do is target elites or members of the population to encourage them to want to comply with the agreement.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Todd is with us from Michigan, driving now in Wisconsin. Todd, hello.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
What do you want to bring up, Todd?
I have a question. You know, it's regarding the nuclear, you know, deal with Iran. I think it's too late now to contain Iran because, you know, it should be done since 2006. It's too late now. I guess, you know, Iran is very capable, you know, right now to make the nuclear bomb. So I think the only pressure we can put on Iran is, you know, the sanctions and, you know, try to also put some pressure on Iraqi government, you know, because they have a lot of funds goes through, you know, Iraq, you know, matter of fact.
Todd, thanks a lot for the call. So the barn door is being closed after the horse is out of the barn, it sounds like, Rupal. Is Iran too far advanced to really matter what we do with negotiations now?
I don't think so. I think that one of the clear principles from the Obama administration and the other members of the Iran nuclear deal from 2015 was that we still had time. There was still an opportunity to stop stop this from happening. And I think that that's still true today. Certainly we have months to try to stop this. And even if the barn is out of the horse is out of the barn already, we certainly have an opportunity to disincentivize the use of nuclear weapons, even if they're used to coerce or to deter other adversaries in the region or to threaten adversaries in the region. There's still a lot of work that can be done through diplomacy.
Thanks a lot for that call, Todd. We're talking to Rupal Mehta, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, author of the book Delaying Doomsday, The Politics of Nuclear Reversal, looking at Iran, the U.S., and negotiations over a nuclear weapons program in Iran. Rupal, this is not new technology. Nuclear weapons have been with us since 1945, basically. And the amazing thing in some ways is, contrary to a lot of fears early on, every country doesn't have nuclear weapons. I mean, in some ways, this is a non-proliferation success story over the past 7 or 8 decades, isn't it?
Absolutely. And in fact, it was President John F. Kennedy that was really concerned that we'd see, 100 plus countries with nuclear weapons. Thankfully, we have not seen that for the most part because these weapons are incredibly expensive. They take a lot of very high resourced countries with developed personnel skill sets to be able to operate them. That was one of the problems Libya had, is they didn't have the necessary personnel to actually develop and operate nuclear weapons. And third, the United States and other members of the international community have been very effective in stopping the spread of nuclear weapons through these negotiations and through these deals, whether or not it's through the creation of NATO to try to increase the defensive capability and deterrent power of European countries without them developing their own nuclear weapons, or through private military and economic assistance, providing, for example, a defensive security agreement to countries in East Asia like Taiwan and Japan and South Korea. All three of those factors combined, I think, have made this truly a non-proliferation success story.
Looking at Iran, the U.S., and nuclear negotiations with Rupal Mehta from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Time for another caller. Andrew is with us in Waukesha. Andrew, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. So I don't claim to be an expert on the issue. I would like to hear the guests' opinions on what are the United States options if Iran simply develops nuclear weapons. I mean, what incentive does Iran have? Because I don't see any evidence that the United States public is going to support drastic countermeasures against a country that has withstood invasion numerous times. And the last time I remember us doing it in the 70s was to rescue hostages. That ended in a complete failure.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Rupal, options, including military options, Andrew's wondering about if Iran just goes flat out and develops nuclear weapons.
That's certainly an option. I think it's probably the lowest likelihood and high risk option, in part because you definitely don't want to go and attack a country that has nuclear weapons in case they detonate. I think other options include increased sanctions, trying to bring leaders to the table, and at the worst case scenario, sort of what we're doing with North Korea, is managing a nuclear state. I think that's the least preferred option for Iran. Certainly no policy maker or member of the policy community in the United States or elsewhere wants to see a nuclear Iran. But I think we are going to be faced with a very different prospect if we get there. Hopefully, these discussions, these talks in Vienna, the negotiations with the new administration, both in the United States and Iran, would avoid that potential. But we're dealing with a very dangerous and very different prospect if we do have Iran eventually go and develop nuclear weapons.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rupal. In just our last minute, what are you watching for next?
I'm looking for any signs of progress from the Vienna talks, especially given the most recent election. I'm looking for intelligence coming out of the IAEA and from other international organizations about where the Iranians actually stand in terms of their nuclear progress. And mostly, I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that we can have continued discussions of diplomacy so that we can avoid the fate that we're very worried about.
Rupal, thanks again for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That was Rupal Mehta, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and the author of the book Delaying Doomsday, The Politics of Nuclear Reversal. Been talking about Iran, the U.S., and nuclear negotiations.